This is Creepy and Geeky, a part of the Morbidly Beautiful Podcast Network. Welcome to Creepy and Geeky. I'm your host, Robert, and on today's show, we're continuing our series on horror trilogies with the Reanimator series. Joining me for this exploration into the world of H.P. Lovecraft is my son, Harrison. Harrison is also the host of the Saber Vista YouTube channel. Welcome back to the show, Harrison.
Salutations.
All right. So we are talking some Lovecraft, and I know you're a fan of his work.
I am.
And a fan of cosmic horror in general, which we've talked about a couple of times on the show already. So I keep trying to introduce some new movies to you that you might be interested in. You seem to be fairly agreeable to this series as a whole. So
yeah, you've been sending me a lot of different interpretations of cosmic horror, but tonight we're talking about a literal adaptation.
Yes. These first two movies are you know, the Reanimator and Bride of Reanimator. Reanimator itself is an adaptation of the first half of the H.P. Lovecraft stories called Herbert West Reanimator. And then Bride of Reanimator is based on the second half of that story. But Beyond Reanimator, and that's the reason why it's called Beyond Reanimator, is not associated with the Reanimator story at all. It's just a continuation of the movie storyline at that point.
Very much not part of the
original. Yeah. So, and Harrison's actually read the original stories by Lovecraft that these are based on. So he'll have some good reference knowledge as we talk about this, about these movies. So
I got the book right in front of me. Some...
So good. You're more prepared than I am, which is usual for most of my guests. We'll jump right in. We're gonna talk the first Reanimator movie, which came out in 1985, directed by Stuart Gordon, produced by Brian Usna, who is very important to the rest of the series as well, as he directs the next two installments. Starring Jeffrey Combs, Barbara Crampton, and I forgot the other people again.
Let me look it up again. I mean, there's a lot of people in these movies.
Yeah. Well, this one specifically is
Jeffrey Combs. Also, a lot of big horror names. Like, people kind of either got their start in this or, kind of perpetuated their career.
Yeah. So, Jeffrey Combs, Bruce Abbott, Barbara Crampton, and David Gale are the big name major actors in this one. And Barbara Crampton, it's one of her earlier movies. Same for Jeffrey Combs. It's Stuart Gordon's first movie, as he came from a theater background. So the interesting thing about this is that he was talking to a friend and they were discussing that there were a lot of vampire movies and he wanted to do a Frankenstein movie. And this friend said, "Hey, you know, have you ever read Reanimator?" And he had not. He had read most of Lovecraft's work, but except for that one. After reading that, then he was excited. Originally he pitched it as a theater thing, but then realized it wasn't going to work. Then tried to pitch it as a television show. And in the 80s, they said, yeah, that won't work. Horror is better in the movies. And so that's when somebody introduced him to Brian Usna, and they managed to cobble together what they did, and it's now a cult classic of the 80s.
Well, just speaking on the source material, I don't know how someone would. A stage play I can understand, but a TV show seems a little ambitious based on the source material alone.
Well, I mean, obviously they'd have to, you know, flesh it out and everything.
Flesh it out.
Yeah, yeah. They'd have to flesh it out a bit to make it work as a television show, I'm sure. And I guess they were looking at something like a 13 episode season. Something not super long.
There's a certain episodic nature to the original text that could have lent itself to a television show. I think that to a certain degree, it may have allowed them to accomplish a couple things that I think were weaker parts of the movies. But I think that number one, I think that the first movie stands fantastic alone. And then the second movie is just extra fun. That's kind of how I feel about the second one. It just picks up where it left off and then kind of wraps up the narrative of Herbert West. If you're satisfied with the ending that it gives you.
Right. Yeah, no, I think that if you never watch any of the other movies, that if you just watch the first Reanimator, you're pretty set. You know, I think the other movies are okay and they have their unique charms to them, but I think that just watching this first one, you get enough.
Absolutely. You know,
but you know, there, like I said, there's some fun stuff in the later ones, but this one's just classic all on its own. And I think that's the reason why most people, when you talk about Reanimator, most people just talk about the first one. You don't really hear too much about people talking about the other two. That's fair. Mm. I mean, you know, it's I think they're good. They're not great. I think the first one really stands head and shoulders above them all. Pun mostly intended. This one's just a lot of fun. And apparently, though, the comedy wasn't in the first draft of the screenplay, and they kind of like went through, like, as they were, you know, gearing it for production and stuff like that, they started, you know, tinkering with it and adding more and more of the humor into it, which I think helps. It's not like funny like, you know, something like an Evil Dead or, you know, a Shaun of the Dead or something like that, where the comedy's like kind of in your face. This one's more really dark.
It's the best kind of horror comedy because it retains its horrific narrative and nature to it while having comedic brevity to kind of wake the audience up from the insanity that they're watching.
Right. Yeah, I think, you know, it does a good job with that. I think that it's definitely not as funny as, you know, as something like I said, like an Evil Dead or Shaun of the Dead or something like that, where it's billed more as a comedy. Reanimator seems much more of a horror first with some comedic elements, and which are good. They're good comedic elements for sure.
Going back to the like the theater aspect of the film, there is very much a theatricalness about the film in terms of like a more stage oriented sensation, that a lot of the comedy comes off as like really powerful one-liners that like the character could belt out into the theater to kind of get aroused. And that's the kind of fun of it, is that whenever the funny stuff happens, like it kind of lands well. Also, I think just because Jeffrey Combs gets a lot of the comedic lines in regards to his character, and he does a fantastic job of portraying Herbert West in terms of how the text presents him, in terms of a cold, uncaring, and purely scientific mind, to where I feel as though through this film and the way he portrays the character, he carries that through with almost a cold sarcasm to whenever he's presented with an inferior intellect in a way. And that's where a lot of the best lines come from.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I think that, you know, it's definitely, you know, you mentioned that about like him being this cold doctor and stuff. And we discussed this before about how he cares only about the science. Yes. He doesn't even necessarily care about himself or anybody else. Like, he literally cares nothing about the subjects that he's injecting this serum into. You know, they are just literally subjects to him.
Yeah, he has the same cold attachment to the humans that he uses and the corpses that he uses for his experiments, the same way that a scientist would have cold attachment for like animals, like mice or some other kind of test animal. They are a means to
literally just testing subjects. Yeah. And he's just trying to perfect the serum. He's trying to unlock the secrets of life after death. And you know, and that's all that matters. And you see that specifically at the very end, as he's, you know, supposedly dying, you know, and as far as we know, if you only watch the first movie, you think he's dying, he's going to be dead. And then, you know, he throws his bag with the serum and the notes and to Dan, his partner, and who he's mostly roped into this. Dan didn't really want to have anything to do with any of this. And so he throws his notes and is just like, you know, take my research, you know, finish my research. So like, he's all about just the science. Like, he knows he's going to die, but he doesn't care. He wants the formula and everything.
Yeah. Yeah. For him, at least inside of the movies, the whole kind of impetus of the first film is Herbert battling Dr. Hill with their interpretations of where the will of the body comes from. And for Herbert, he believes that will is not something nebulous. It's something that is just inherent in the human body. And he's trying to prove that by reanimating the bodies to showcase how even after death, will continues. That even after all processes stop, the heart stops, the brain stops, that there's still will and rational thought within the body, versus with Dr. Hill, where he believes that everything comes from the brain and believes that there's many points where they butt heads about when will leaves the body. And that's kind of the sticking point between them, which kind of echoes the text a little bit for the like. And in a lot of ways, Herbert's reasoning and rational understanding of why he's doing these experiments and testing his reagent is very similar in both the movie and the book, in that both in the story and the movie, he really has very limited motivation. He's doing it purely just because he can, just because he has this reagent, and he's trying to basically just record as much as he can about it. That how long does it take before the body reacts to it? What kind of thought comes out of it? Like, it's almost like a giddy excitement that he has whenever a body reanimates, and he just wants to record and review everything that happens, no matter what happens, like a violent outburst, a rational thought, a fear response, like whatever happens, he's just gobbling it up.
Yeah. He's right there making notes. Yeah.
Which we talked briefly outside of the podcast about how that is a very 1920s, 1910s, like turn of the century scientific way of thinking.
Well, and I wouldn't even say that's relegated just to then. I'm sure there's scientists these days with that same kind of drive.
But it's that like almost medical detachment that scientist that people had then that is kind of taboo now. A lot of people
like the digging up of bodies and stuff to experiment,
which again, like, is something they did in the tens, which is more than likely where Lovecraft draws a lot of his inspiration for his original text from, is the idea that these medical students were body snatching from unmarked graves to basically test on, or using accident victims as test bodies. I mean, it's like if you have an organ donor symbol on your ID, like someone's going to be churning through your insides once you die.
Oh yeah.
And so I mean, it's stuff like that we still have, but we don't really think about in terms of like the logic of it. But there's some kind of medical horror about the aspect of like, if you die in an accident, like there will be someone who's going to be picking you apart.
Yeah. Yeah, no. And I think it's interesting this, because like you said, we don't know much about Herbert West before the movie starts. There's little to no background given to him at all. And you don't find out anything new in any of the movies. They do a really good job at keeping him. What you know about him is only what you see in the movie. There's no backstory. Yeah,
and from our protagonist's perspective, which in the first two movies is Dan, and then in the third movie we have a new protagonist-esque character that perceives Herbert West in a different way, and that's really kind of core to a lot of Lovecraft's fiction, is that usually we're in the perspective of an onlooker or someone who is perceiving the horrors around them. And that's kind of a really unique sense inside of even the film itself, is that they kind of maintain that. They maintain the idea that we are viewers into this world of insanity that Herbert has concocted with his reagent.
Right. Yeah, no, it's definitely an interesting way to, like, especially in, you know, this day and age where we want to know more about, like, what's his motivations, you know, what's the backstory and all this. And I'm sure there's been stories. I know there's Reanimator comic books and stuff. So maybe they've delved a little bit deeper into like his past or whatever, and, you know, given him some kind of extra story.
Yeah, we meet Kid Herbert.
Yeah.
Figure out which trauma led him down this
right path. But
we don't even know where the reagent comes from. Like, we're introduced to the movie and the reagent is a thing. Like, we don't, already like, exists. There's no pomp and circumstance about the reagent itself. There's no like talk about like, we need these chemicals to come from, make how did the come reagents. Up with, we need to raid the chemical room to get access to these things. Like, no, it's just that he has this reagent. He apparently has plenty of it, or he can make a lot of it, and he just needs bodies. He needs fresher and fresher subjects.
Yeah, and it's just bizarre. But I like it. I like the fact that, you know, you're just, you know, plopped right down into the middle of the story, and you don't really need to know. You know, that's what's great about it, is, you know, we don't need to know. We're just full steam ahead, you know, mad scientist, you know, trying to,
and,
you know, ropes his new roommate into helping him, and fighting against the evil doctor at the hospital.
So. I feel like a lot of movies that came out in the 80s really had this kind of sense of, let's not spend too much of our time on exposition and let's just get right into the movie. Like, you get things like Back to the Future, where it's just like, mad scientist created a time machine. How? We don't really need to know. Like, it's just that he has this time machine and now we're into the movie. And you got aliens. Aliens just throws you in. You're in space. You're on this like weird space freighter, and like the thing, like, suddenly we're seeing like a helicopter chasing down a dog. Like, we don't know what's going on. Like, there's no real exposition. It just kind of throws us into the action.
Right.
And I think that it's something that's kind of unique about this time period of movies, is that a lot of movies really just wanted to kind of like hook you right from the start, like during the opening credits, like wanted you to be involved in the story, wanted to know what's going on. And this movie does that in spades, because it immediately presents this situation where like there are police heading down this hallway, and like there's like screaming, and like people are like really concerned, and then you like they bash down the door and you see Herbert like hovering over like this old man with this needle, and you're like, oh, what is going on? But that we don't know. He just says that it was an overdose, and that's all the information we give before it goes into the opening credits. which kind of sets the stakes, introduces the main character, and introduces a lot of the like central core ideas of the film, that like that there's this green reagent, it does something and it kills people. So
right.
Yeah. I just think that that's a great, great sentiment that I think is missing in some modern movies.
Right. No, I think there's definitely movies that still do that, but definitely the 80s were a weird time where, you know, and I've been going back a lot and watching quite a few 80s movies as I've been, you know, filling in gaps in my horror, you know, history. And so when I watch stuff, it's interesting to see movies. Some movies, they'll give you a little prologue and, you know, get you up to speed and everything like that. But so many movies of the 80s just kind of ended and ended in weird ways that you're just like, okay.
Mm-hmm.
I could have used a little bit more, you know, resolution sure. to that. But, you know, these movies were just like, nope, it's done. We're done. And, you know, it's definitely something that I've noticed in storytelling in general, that at least in terms of movies and maybe comic books and stuff like that, that storytelling's gotten better in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. And you can see it with this, even with this renaissance in television that we have nowadays, is that, you know, the storytelling just has gotten better. Not that the stories that came before were bad, and I'm not saying that at all, just that we have a different way of telling stories now. Sure. So that when they can do it, when you watch something from the past that is different, is like the old way, but they do it well, you can appreciate that more. And I think that's, you know, that's Reanimator does that really well as well, because, you know, when it ends on this note of, oh, well, this isn't over, but, mm-hmm. you know, but it fades to black, and mm-hmm. you know, but
well,
so it's,
that's actually indicative of even the source material, because
oh, yeah?
the way that they were written was they were written as very short stories that were included in a magazine, I believe.
Oh, right, right.
And the way that they end is oftentimes Lovecraft ended them with a cliffhanger.
Right. And, yeah, that makes sense.
And they ended with like a single line of like, let me see if I can find one. Oh yes, this one is actually my favorite. Help, keep off, you cursed little toehead fiend. Keep that damned needle away from me. And that's the last line of one of the short stories. And so like that's where it would end. And then you would just flip the next page and it'd be someone else's horror story.
Right.
And so
you have to wait for the next month for part two.
So it kind of makes sense. Like when the movie ends with Dan going over another person with the needle, and it just goes into the theme of the movie and cuts to credits. Like that's very Lovecraftian in terms right. of how he was writing these stories. And so, and
like I said, that even
to that, even in the second one.
Yeah. And that's, I mean, how it happens with love with Herbert Weston in at least these first two movies as well, is that, you know, he seemingly dies in both of the first two movies. We see what seems to be his death, but he manages to come back for another movie. So you're just like, and they don't explain it either, which is crazy. Like each one of these is just so funny that they don't, like, he seemingly dies, but they don't explain it in the next one. And so it just again starts,
which is also indicative of the source material in a way. Because I can very much tell as I was reading them that Lovecraft, number one, I believe that it's on record that Lovecraft wasn't a huge fan of the Herbert West stories. He did them
right.
Purely for monetary reasons, because people were really into Frankenstein, and so he was creating his own necromancer type character. And but for his stories, I can tell he wrote them in such a way that he really did think that there was one story where this was the end, because it specifically says like, and Herbert West was never seen again. And then the next story starts, and then it's a whole nother story of Herbert West, but before he disappeared.
That's so funny. That's interesting. I'm glad that they held so well to the source material then.
It was actually surprising to me because I actually read the story after I watched the movie. And so because I was interested to know more about the source material, and it's really impressive how much they were able to hold themselves to the source material while also updating it to allow for a larger, grander story to fit inside of a movie.
Bring it to modern times as well.
Yeah, and bring it into modern times, which is something that I think that more people doing cosmic horror, especially Lovecraft adaptations, need to do.
Right.
Because Lovecraft was writing for a particular audience. He was writing for people who lived in the 1910s, the 1920s,
right.
Who were dealing with scientific discoveries and the kind of like fear and misunderstanding and the kind of nebulous nature of a lot of these things, because this was the kind of like renaissance of scientific thought. And so it was scary. It was a complete new understanding of the world. And so people were creating new forms of science, some of them valid, some of them very not so. And so he kind of explores a lot of those inside of his story. And for Lovecraftian stories today, I really do think that they need to do this more, especially in like an example like Herbert West is bringing it into the modern context of the 80s, but having the same kind of like Victorian horror that Lovecraft has inside of his stories, but bringing it into the modern day.
Right. Yeah, no, I think that's really cool. And I agree. I think that, you know, if you're going to it, I don't think you have to bring it into the modern day. I mean, if you can tell a good story, a good adaptation of something like that and keep it in the original time period, fine. You know,
but I am
actually more interested in seeing somebody bring it into the modern day and making it work around that and trying to apply the same concepts to our modern era, because I think that would be more interesting in general, but also for most people, you know, that you'd reach a much wider audience with that kind of aspect to it.
Completely agree. I think that there's certain stories that work better as period pieces rather than others. Like, for example, I would find At the Mountains of Madness to be a little impractical to do inside of the modern era, just because that is a story of the technical limitations and dangers involved in exploring the Arctic in the 20s. And they butt heads against their technology and their resources quite a lot inside of that, which in a more modern expedition to the Antarctic, which like while still challenging, there's a lot more things that we have technologically that would assist them. Also, it's a little less likely that they would get lost in the same ways that they get lost inside of that story with things GPS and like satellite imaging. And so, so certain stories like that, definitely. I think for like medical horror, like Herbert West, like I think it was very smart of him to bring it into the modern era. So that way it wasn't just like... Period pieces can turn off some viewers. And so I think that part of the reason why it's such a cult classic is because it wasn't a period piece. Because I think that there's a chance that it could have been disregarded if it was a period piece. And it wouldn't have had the same relatability to the audiences that probably saw it at the time. Real quick, I just want to go into specifically the first movie and kind of go into some of the things that actually stood out to me when reading. In terms of the similarities between the text, because I find that fascinating on just how closely they actually followed it. So Dr. Halsey is the dean of the Arkham Medical Institute inside of the story, and he is an antagonist to Herbert and his research. While I don't believe we get a name to our protagonist is our Dan character in terms of the novel. And basically he goes along with Herbert just because he's fascinated by his research and like is fascinated by the fact that he has this reagent that is able to do this. But much like the movie, maybe Herbert is constantly in search of a fresher corpse, something from an accident, something that hasn't had any damage, that it was a vigorous body. And they do revive a muscular figure, and they wait a while and find that it takes a long time for him to actually reanimate, and then he attacks them, which is how one of the first stories ends. And they basically have to flee their home. So instead of inside of the morgue, it happens inside of their home.
Right.
So they have to flee, and then they don't know what happened to that one. That one just kind of escapes. There's reports of like claws on a loose grave, like in the local newspaper afterward, but it just escapes. And so Herbert has this kind of like looming dread over his shoulder of like this thing finding him again. So very Frankenstein, like just having his monster escape. And then the next one is when Dr. Halsey actually dies. And I believe that Halsey dies kind of very like altruistically. He isn't murdered. He kind of has his heart fail while having to take care of a lot of people in a very like intense medical situation. And but Herbert gets his hands on his body, and in a weird like kind of slight, like it's not explicitly said inside of the text, but in a weird way of like revenge almost on him for limiting his research, he does inject him with the reagent to reanimate him. And like inside of the movie, Dr. Halsey goes insane and is locked up and put inside of an asylum. And that's where he basically stays for 16 years. It's a really long period of time. That's pretty much where it ends in terms of the similarities to the first few stories. But one thing I want to point out, though, is that there's a character that's introduced later on inside of the short stories known as Major Sir Eric Moreland Clapham Lee, DSO, which was someone who, very long name. Who was introduced inside of the chapters about the Great War, which is somewhat picked up on inside of the second movie, but contextualized inside of the 80s rather than the 1910s. And he essentially fills the Dr. Hill role in terms of the novels, or not novels, but the short stories, because his head is lopped off and they inject the body with the serum, and then the head independently reanimates without being injected.
Interesting.
And they essentially lose him. Like they lose the body and the head, and then the head and the body comes back later on with the fact that this body knows Herbert's research and is able to bring people back from the dead and build a undead army in the same way that Dr. Hill does inside of the first movie. And he even travels around with a wax head on his shoulders. And he carries his head to his side. So very much like Dr. Hill inside of the first movie. And so it's really interesting how they kind of took a lot of the things from the Lovecraft narrative, but built an actual movie around it by adding this antagonist of Dr. Hill inside of the first movie, rather than having an incredibly long name, they truncated it down to Dr. Hill, which actually not a doctor, but there is a character called Ronald Hill that is mentioned inside of one of the books, which I actually don't know what the first name of Dr. Hill is, which would be kind of interesting if it is Ronald Hill, if they just kind of took another name from...
It's Carl in the movie.
Oh, it's Carl. Okay. Yeah. I found that really interesting that's how they kind of married it together. And then in regards to the second movie kind of picks up the like core narrative in terms of chronologically as Lovecraft even put them out regarding the future of Herbert, especially after he serves during some conflict and uses the conflict's surplus of bodies that comes into his medical tent as basically free test subjects.
Oh, okay.
And so,
interesting.
But I'm assuming you might have some more to talk about the first one before we hop on to the second one.
I just wanted to talk about the performances, really. You know, I really enjoy Jeffrey Combs in this. You know, it's one of the, I wasn't super familiar with any of his work. I'm sure I'd seen him in other things before I saw him in this. And I only saw these movies recently, in the last few years, for the first time. So I'm sure I've seen him in other things, because I know he's, you know, been around for quite a bit. And but I really enjoyed his performance in this, like we mentioned before, you know, that detached kind of, you know, mad scientist that he is.
He really delivered in this movie on the idea that he was this cold, purely scientific person that had no ethical or moral philosophy that was being compromised by anything that he was doing, and that he was doing it purely from the rational perspective.
Yeah. And, you know, and I just, you know, he brings a lot of that comedy and stuff to it that, you know, just because of that, you know, kind of heightened kind of madness that he has in there. I, you know, one of the my favorite lines, you know, and apparently it's, you know, a favorite line of a lot of people is who's going to believe a talking head? Get a job in a sideshow. And I just love that line, because it's a great delivery and it's just such a bizarre thing to say. I mean, obviously the whole, you know, scenario is bizarre because he is talking to a guy who's holding his head in his hand.
It's just a fun line. It really brought a lot of brevity to that sequence. Don't get me wrong, it's an intense movie. There's gore, there's great effects, there's great practical effects. That's something we really haven't talked about just yet, but the practical effects inside the movie are fantastic. It helps the movie stand the test of time, and really keeps it from looking too aged. Especially, I can't remember for Beyond Reanimator if there's too much CGI that's used, but I think that there's a little bit that's used that kind of,
yeah, Beyond it. Reanimator has a little bit more, yeah, for sure, because it's a 90s movie, so
that's, yeah, when, and so
they started using CG a lot more.
I really appreciate when, and we discussed this a little bit before too, about how for 80s movies, because there really wasn't access to CGI in the same ways that it is today, that everything just has that visceral quality to it, because they really had to figure out, like, okay, what can we get at the grocery store to make it look how we want it to look? And and there's just so much unbound creativity with a lot of like the miniature work, the effects work, and a lot of the other stuff that goes into a lot of these older movies in terms of how they were able to pull off a lot of these shots that otherwise would have been impossible with the technology and the limitations of filmmaking inside of the 80s. And so for me, I think that they did a fantastic job on this first one. Like, I personally, for me, like, I think it's just a great film. I think they just made a fantastic film. Like, I can't think of anything particularly damning in it, beyond I can't remember her name, but Dan's girlfriend inside of the film has some pretty brutal acting at some of the points in the film, but I'm understanding that she becomes a scream queen later on, and I'm sure that this is one of her earlier roles.
Figures
that out.
Well, she'd been on soap operas before this as well, so, you know, her acting may, her most of her acting may, and again, part of it I think was, you know, soap opera experience, but also part of it is the text, the script, and part of it's the theatricality of it all. Again, you know, Stuart Gordon comes from this theater background, so his direction's probably going to be more of, you know, make it bigger, you know, make it.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, so, but yeah, Barbara Crampton, she played Megan, and she, you know, she's definitely a huge person in horror. This was, I think, one of, if not her first big horror role. And she goes on to do quite a few horror movies after this. And she took some time off, you know, to be with her family, and then has come roaring back even more so now, where she's actually a major producer helping smaller movies get made. So which is really cool. She's such a big proponent for horror movies. And I love to see actors who don't shy away from that. People who got their start. There's so many actors who got their starts in horror movies who, after just a couple, have like kind of turned their back on it. And I get it. Maybe that wasn't something you were really interested in, but I love the actors who love the genre and who come back and like are just like, okay, yes, let's do everything we can to, you know, keep moving horror forward and take it to interesting places and stuff. So I really like Barbara Crampton for that, because you know, not only is she's actually a really good actress, but she, you know, she's such a huge a part of the horror community in general. So
yeah, and she's, yeah, all, and her character is very central to the plot in the second, yeah, film
to a degree, even though she's not
at least
in
her heart
the
is.
Movie at all. Yeah. Yeah, her heart's in the right place.
Yes.
Or is it?
Yeah. But yeah, no, that's what is interesting. Like, I guess they did ask her to, or I guess they were going to have her back, but then her manager told her not to, because he didn't want her getting typecast into horror. And so, well, so, and then eventually, you know, that's what she, yeah. Yeah. So, but I like that, you know, and she's really big about, you know, even with, yeah, I mean, because she goes on to star in another Stuart Gordon H.P. Lovecraft movie. She does From Beyond with Jeffrey Combs again. Mm-hmm. And then they go on to do another one, Castle Freak. All three of them are together again for that one as well. So, I mean, she obviously enjoyed working with them and has had a good time doing it. So it's good, you know, obviously, you know, not doing Bride of Reanimator was, you know, it's whatever, but... yeah, I just think she's a great actress. It's really cool. But yeah, let's go ahead and move on into Bride of Reanimator, since we're talking about it. This one moves ahead, a little bit. I'm not sure exactly.
Yeah, a few years.
Yeah. And you know, Dan and Herbert West are together, and they're in some war-torn area. And basically using the corpses, they're there as doctors, but of course Herbert West is using the corpses as experiments for his reagent.
But now the new thing that's introduced inside of this movie is that now Herbert is using reptilian regeneration as part of the serum.
Right. Yes.
And that there's some aspect of utilizing reptiles' natural ability to regenerate their body parts in order to independently reanimate not whole bodies but just body parts.
Yes.
As well as a somewhat sickening fascination of attaching human body parts to animals, or animal body parts to animals, or to humans.
Yeah.
And so there's a lot of kind of shenaniganery that occurs inside of this movie.
Right. This one, because this one is actually directed by Brian Usna, who's, you know, most well known to people for directing the 1980s movie, Society, which is a pretty gross and, you know, goofy body horror movie. Brian Usna is, obviously, you look at his filmography and he's a pretty big fan of body horror. So this one leans more into body horror than the first movie does.
Certainly.
So this one's interesting because of those aspects. This one utilizes a little bit more. I don't think it's computer generation. I think they're using stop motion animation.
It feels a little more like The Thing in a way, like the way that things move is a little jerky.
Right. Well, I think that's stop motion. So,
yeah.
It's this one, like all these movies, like I said, all these movies are good. This one's less good than the first one for me. I think it's still interesting in a lot of ways, but this one's definitely doing something different, because, you know, Dan is obsessed with reanimating Megan, because she died after the first, or died at the end of the first movie.
Yeah.
But they've saved her heart and they're waiting for like a good donor to, you know, to put it into. But that's kind of what they're doing. They're actually kind of this time, this one's more Frankenstein, because they're actually building a body out of all these different body parts that they're scavenging, basically. And, you know, that they're going to eventually put Megan's heart into, to kind of recreate her. That's the whole,
based on Herbert's interpretation, because Herbert essentially is now under the assumption that because now he can reanimate entire body, like only body parts, that means that the will is not even in the brain or anywhere at all, because in the first movie they were applying it to the brainstem. They were still applying it to the brain in a way. And so there was still this idea that the brain was the source of life. But with this one, it is expressly determined that the will is in whatever body part you want it to be in.
Right.
And so they kind of put it. So with this, the idea is that somehow Megan's consciousness remains in her heart. And it's somewhat symbolic of the idea that if you put Megan's heart inside of a new body, it would still be the same Megan, but it would be inside of some new amalgam. This is where things just go far afield of Lovecraft's original writing. Number one, Megan was not even in the story to begin with. And so there's no love interest that's ever introduced inside of the short stories. Okay. And so this one, it really dives deep into the idea of this love interest and the bride of reanimator aspect of it. I'm definitely leaning into like, okay, how do we make this more like Frankenstein, where we like lean a little heavier into the Hammer horror-ness of this. But with that said, though, there is a few things that actually stay true to the text. Some of them include the fact that Herbert uses reptile regeneration as a method to animate individual body parts. That is a part of the original text, is that that is how he figures out how to do it. In terms of when he creates the headless antagonist against him, that eventually leads into the ending of this film, which actually almost directly mirrors the ending of the actual short story series, is that he places the head of Sir Clapham Lee inside of a vat of these like reptilian cells. And that's what makes it even more horrifying, is that he didn't even inject him with the serum. He just injects the body with it, and then inside of the vat comes the voice of Clapham Lee as the building around them collapses. And so kind of an interesting twist on that in a way. But in regards to that, moving on from that, we inside of this movie, we see the return of Dr. Hill. In the first movie, his head's totally squashed, like pancake. And we do see inside of this movie that, like, I actually do believe he submerges his head at one point inside of the reagent, and that's how he heals. So there is, or maybe it's even the reptilian cells. I can't actually remember. So there might be actually something about that inside right. of the film about trying to mimic that from the original text. And he regenerates. And then now Dr. Hill's back and he wants to kill Herbert West.
Right.
And he has he goes in. Her so Hill's head is in the possession of like the morgue operator inside of the Miskatonic University, and there's a whole exchange between them where Hill psychically controls him to create more bodies as well as more reagents, so that way he can basically go and attack Herbert. Meanwhile, Herbert and Dan are just in the process of just collecting body parts in order to create Dan's new Megan. Like new love interest. Whereas with Herbert, he's just doing it for the hell of it. Like I couldn't right. really tell what his like motivation was beyond just like almost trying to make Dan happy.
I think it's more about keeping Dan on his side. You know, he's constantly yes, yeah. even in
like he needs an assistant
in movies. He needs an assistant, and Dan is, you know, if he can keep Dan there by this promise of recreating Meg for him or whatever, then mm-hmm. that's what he'll do, you know? So he's just, yeah.
It's yeah, just no, it gives Dan a little yeah. more agency in the film versus the main character inside of the short stories. He's just kind of with Herbert because he's yeah. with him. Like they're yeah. beyond the scientific nature of everything. The main character really doesn't have any motivation along with her. Right. Yeah. And yeah, so this one, if it seems like we're talking about this one less, it's because it's a lot shorter. It's a very yeah. short film. And well,
it's not and just that, but this one's just, again, I like these movies, but this one doesn't have a whole lot to it because, I mean, again, he's fighting Dr. Hill. Now, don't get me mm-hmm. wrong, Dr. Hill has bat wings on his head now, so he's able to fly around, which is fun and goofy and everything, but
oh yeah,
it takes a while for that to happen.
A little less than I would have wanted. I would have wanted a little more bat Dr. Hill,
yeah,
because I loved the goofiness of it.
But yeah, but he's but overall I think that this one just it doesn't hold together as well as the first one.
Yeah, and there's also this kind of subplot to this film where there's this police officer who had his wife yeah. reanimated by Herbert after she right. died, and now she's locked inside of an insane asylum along with some of Herbert's other test subjects that have been
right.
caught and gathered up because people think that they've just gone insane rather than believing them to be corpses. And so there's this whole kind of subplot about that where the cop just basically wants to kill Herbert and find out
right.
if he was the one responsible. And
yeah. And that subplot is just like, fun.
It felt like it was a way to pad the time on the movie right. on an already very short movie. And so right. it felt weird to just have this like secondary plot on top of everything. And then also Dan has like a new girlfriend that he met during the war
love interest of sorts. Yeah.
She's basically trying to like, it's basically a challenge. So Dan is working to build this bride, with right. Megan's heart, his old girlfriend's heart, while he's also with this new girl, Francesca, who is basically trying to pull him away from Herbert by saying like, right. he's dangerous and you don't know what he's doing. And but Dan is too hyper-focused on the possibility of having Megan come back, which kind of comes to a head at the very end where the right. bride awakens after getting the reagent injected. Actually, I believe through her entire circulatory system. I think it was the whole gimmick of it was that the idea right. had
well,
to be
yeah,
that
it would
had
have to go to through be all every the body parts. Part. Yeah.
And so they basically recreate like a whole like right circulatory system. Yes. Yeah. And so it creates this whole circulatory system that then awakens the bride, who is this very like bride of Frankenstein, just like very distant, eyes wide open, like talking yeah. with a mouth open in whispers. Very Hammer Whore. In the way that it was presented. And, but basically Dan's like,
oh, you're not my girlfriend. I'm going to go with this girl named Francesca. And then girl gets mad and then she starts tearing herself apart.
Rips her heart out.
She can't live with the fact that she was rejected by Dan in her like mutated reagent form. Meanwhile, Herbert's got his own problems because Dr. Hill's back and he has reanimated a lot of corpses, and they have moved into a brand new house that is right next to a tomb, which has provided Herbert with a lot of useful bodies. Useful body parts for his research, but it has also created a problem for him because now it's just a gateway to getting into his house to kill him. Which, in regards to the actual story, the final chapter of the Reanimator series is actually called Tomb Legions, and specifically deals with the fact that Sir Clapham Lee goes to the Miskatonic morgue, reanimates a couple servants, then mails his head to Herbert, which is what happens inside
the movie.
And Herbert opens it up and sees the head of Clapham Lee, and Clapham Lee basically gives him an ultimatum about how he's going to die, and Herbert rejects it, throws it down, and runs to the basement, but finds that the masonry on the side of the wall is being torn away by the Tomb Legions, and basically a bunch of undead walk in single file, and Herbert, inside of the short story, actually kind of just accepts it. He just kind of stands still with no fear on his face and just accepts the reality of his creations destroying him, knowing full well that the horrors that he's created. And actually, inside of the short story, it is very explicit that he's dead, because there's a description of him being torn apart by these creatures. And then the house collapses on them, which is exactly what happens inside of the movie as well, is that these zombies break through right after Dan rejects his zombie bride, and they attack and they try to flee, but Herbert, Dan, and Francesca are all crushed by the house, but then it's revealed at the end of the film that Dan and Francesca get away, which inside of the actual novel, or the short story, keep saying novel. inside of the short story, the main character does get away, and he was within the room at the time that the legions consume Herbert. I am very surprised that between the journey from Stuart Gordon to Brian Usna, the authenticity to the original narrative that they held in regards to Herbert West's story, like Lovecraft's original story. And I think that Stuart Gordon was very wise in his use of taking things from the later chapters of the narrative and bringing them into the first film. Whereas I feel that it ended up leaving Brian Usna with not a whole lot to actually pull from. And so he ended up really pulling from the last like three chapters of the narrative and having to kind of pull in all of this like information about like the reptile tissue, the war, the fact that Dr. Hill, it comes back, like the headless doctor comes back to wreak havoc on Herbert. And having the idea of these like undead breaking through like a cemetery wall. And so there was enough there for him to kind of do something with, but I feel like he felt like he had to fill it in somehow. And so he created this whole like Bride of Reanimator narrative to kind of bridge it even closer to Frankenstein, which some things work, some things don't. For me, I think the movie was strongest whenever we saw Herbert just toying around with the reagent and just creating his like horrible like animal human abominations that he was creating. Like I think he put like an ear he put like a hand on something. I can't remember what it was.
He connected fingers, just fingers, not even hands, just connected fingers to each other with an eyeball.
Yes. And, yes, he created a little eyeball spider. And then he also, I believe, attached an arm to a foot, like an arm and a leg. And then it ended up kicking him and choking him. This one really kind of leaned a little more into the Evil Dead kind of humor aspect of it. And this one was definitely more, it felt to me more comedy than horror versus the first one that I felt was more horror than comedy. And so it kind of, it bridges the gap well. And it, and I believe it does give, I can't remember any fantastic one-liners for Herbert, but I believe it gives them a couple. I think there's a couple in the second one that they give him. And so it does feel like a worthy sequel, but it doesn't hold up to the same level of quality that the first one delivered. And and that's kind of a disappointment. I will give it props for staying true to the source material.
Well, an interesting thing here is that the cop's name in this was Lieutenant Leslie Chapin. So,
Right.
holding a little closer to that.
Yeah.
And Francesco is played by somebody you'll recognize if you hadn't already, but you won't recognize her by name, but she was played by Fabiana Udinio.
Mm-hmm. She was a lot of vagina in Austin Powers.
Yes. So
I recognized her immediately.
Did you? Okay. Yeah. 80s fans will recognize her from the movie Summer School as well. She was in that. She was the foreign exchange student in that. So it's a
body horror and Austin Powers. I am a mixed bag.
Oh yeah. Very mixed bag. But yeah, no, I agree with you. I think this movie is, it borders on the silly at times. And I think that the comedy, whereas we said, you know, the first one's more horror than comedy, but the comedy helps punctuate it in ways. This one is almost a little too silly. And it kind of undermines it in ways that the first movie doesn't get undermined.
I would still say it's worth a watch.
No, especially it's definitely worth a watch. Especially if you still enjoy it.
The first Reanimator. I think that if you're looking for a fun, goofy sequel to it, it's definitely worth a watch.
This one came out in 91.
No, Silent Night, Deadly Night 2. It is actually, it's way, like, in comparison, it is way better,
right?
Honestly, which is kind of surprising to say. But it, I guess it's not a high bar. But it, For a horror sequel done by a different director, continuing a narrative that, like, was left on somewhat of a cliffhanger, but didn't necessarily need a sequel, I would say that it's a worthy watch. Like, it's definitely worth watching.
Yeah. Oh yeah, I would agree. But yeah, that brings us to Beyond Reanimator,
point where I close the book.
Yes, because it literally is Beyond Reanimator,
because there's nothing in the original text about what happens in this movie.
So whereas the original Reanimator came out in 1985, Bride of Reanimator came out in 1991, but I believe Bride of Reanimator was actually filmed in 89.
It definitely feels like a movie that was filmed in the 80s.
Yeah. So it was filmed in 89, but didn't come out till 91.
The public wasn't ready for it. For a hard-hitting horror movie like Bride of Reanimator.
And then Beyond Reanimator came out in 2003. And Beyond Reanimator was part of this new kind of studio thing where there was this Spanish production company that was that Brian Usna was a part of, that they made like 5 or 6 movies. One of them was Beyond Reanimator. Another one was Dagon. And there were a couple more. And Dagon was another Lovecraft movie done by Stuart Gordon. You know, he's definitely a fan of
keeping up appearances,
Lovecraft. So this one, Beyond Reanimator, like I said, 2003. This one is again directed by Brian Usna, The only person to return for this one is Jeffrey Combs. No Dan this time. Nobody else. No Dr. Hill.
Dan is finally done with Herbert shenanigans.
Yeah. Yes. And this time we get a new assistant of sorts. But this time Herbert's in jail. He's been incarcerated for the events of.
I can't imagine why.
So he's been incarcerated supposedly for the events that happened in the first two movies. You get tax a little evasion. Prologue. You get a little prologue of what happened. There was like a kid and his sister, and they were attacked by one of the reanimated. The sister dies. Herbert West is arrested. And then the kid, sees the a vial or syringe of reagent on the ground, and as Herbert is being pulled away, and then it's a few years later, and now this kid is now an adult, and he's being transferred into this prison that Herbert West is at, and he's becoming the new doctor of the prison. They try really hard to present this prison as an American prison, but it is so obvious this is a Spanish production because all of the actors are Spanish and they're overdubbed with American accents and everything. Mm-hmm. So yeah. it's a little weird and off-putting.
One thing that I find interesting about the idea of the film. Because I think there's a moment in the film that almost implies that he is not the doctor that was actually supposed to be assigned there.
Yeah,
I might be imagining that, but I think I remember a moment where there's a kind of a throwaway line that he almost kind of forced his way in so that way he could see Herbert. And he's almost impersonating. I believe I might be wrong about that, but I think that there's an essence of. An idea that he's impersonating.
I think that's supposed to be the idea. Yeah. I don't know if he just forged something or something. Yeah.
Yeah. So just to establish some characters so that way we can begin our discussion. This one, we have our son of Reanimator, if you will, introduced is the doctor that comes in. To see Herbert because of his childhood trauma of having his sister be killed by one of his creations. And then we also have this like news reporter woman who's at the prison.
She's doing like a story on the prison. Yeah,
she's just kind of there doing a story on the prison, just happened to be there.
I think she's just meant to be the new female co-lead, because we've had them through each one of them so far. Interesting aside real quick, this actress is Elsa Pataky, who goes on to be in the in some of the Fast and the Furious franchise. She plays the I don't remember her name now, but she's the Brazilian cop in Fast Five that that Dominic ends up having a relationship and a kid with. Also she is Chris Hemsworth's real life wife.
She's definitely the love interest of the film. She's introduced as this kind of
like almost like an investigative reporter.
Investigative reporter who's kind of trying to get in the scoop on the prison. But then we also get our villain, our Dr. Hill, if you will, of this movie, because we don't have a Dr. Hill. Dr. Hill doesn't come back for this one. But we get the warden, who is the villain of this story, who's kind of this like sexual harasser of this reporter. And so where you immediately don't like this guy as he is kind of coming on to the report. And the reporter's just trying to do her job. But the reporter and our son of Reanimator, they both kind of hit it off. And they have their own relationship that begins. So our new Dan has a new Megan. So that way we can keep that going. But the new thing. So last time it was reptilian cells were the key to regeneration.
Right.
Now it's electroplasmic neurons or something like that. It's
right.
Basically, Herbert walks around with these like little vacuum tubes that whenever he kills something with electricity, he kind of captures their neuron essence in a way. Like it's kind of vague. Like there's a little bit of
right.
like almost an attempt to be kind of poetic about it, where it's like, is it their soul or is it not their soul? Is it just like right. a scientific yeah. thing? And
yeah, it's like a bioelectricity.
Yeah. And he kind of traps it inside of these little light bulbs. And then when at the moment of reanimation, that's when you're supposed to jab this light bulb into the body and it discharges this like soul-like energy into whatever body it is, and it gains the consciousness or behavior of whatever it came from.
Right.
This establishes some tension in the movie about how Herbert kills the pet rat of another one of the prisoners to take its essence. Herbert still has his kind of cold, distant scientific attachment to everything. And so he just doesn't care. Like he doesn't care that right. all these prisoners are about to beat him up. And so he just kind of goes on with everything. And then eventually our character meets up with the son of Reanimator and they start doing their experimentation.
Son of Reanimator.
it's what, how I felt about it.
Right.
And
this one's definitely, it's a marked difference between the Dan character in the first two movies. And in this yes. one, this guy's just going along with whatever, you know, he's
yeah, there's on, no
like his assistant the whole time, yeah, helping him like, do everything, whatever he wants to do, he does it for him.
Yeah. So, which is why it feels more like a son of Reanimator, because there right. is no, there is no agency to this character beyond his relationship with the reporter right. character. And so basically they like a couple of the prisoners die due to like health circumstances. And so they apply this new method of regeneration onto them. And it causes them to like react in horrid ways by putting like rat energy inside of a person. And so that makes them act like a rat and makes them a little more violent. And so eventually it kind of all comes to a head when the warden kills the reporter character for right. rejecting his advances. And then that's kind of the catalyst that moves us towards our climax. Because now, of course, Son of Reanimator wants to revive the reporter and wants right. to revive her in the right way. And so I actually can't remember where they get the neurons for her. It's the warden, I think, actually. Because that's kind Could of the be, whole yeah. thing later on, is that they kind of share a body for a bit.
Yeah.
So yeah, because the warden's a pretty messed up dude. Like the warden
yeah.
in
yeah.
this is like kind of a murderous rampager.
Yeah, he doesn't care that people are dying and he's actively killing some of the prisoners. Yeah. As well.
I mean, hell, he kills a reporter for rejecting his advances. Right. So I mean, he's not the best guy. And so when they take his essence and then put it inside of her, when they reanimate her, it causes her to come back, and she has some of her consciousness, but she also has the bridged consciousness of the warden. And so she has this split personality where now she's surprisingly violent at times, but then she kind of wakes up from it, almost like a Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde situation, where she wakes up from it and is kind of horrified at what she's done. And then beyond that, because the warden is dead, Herbert, in his vast levels of hubris, puts the reagent inside of him, as well as the rat essence that he's had
right.
for a while, and creates the rat warden, which right. is it's this own like kind of murderous, dangerous character that ends up basically sending the entire prison into some form of chaos, where like there's a whole climax where there's a big prison break. Everything's on fire. People are running around killing each other. The people right. who are mad at Herbert for killing the rat are coming after him. They're also coming after the reporter lady because they're also sexual harassers. And they're coming after her. Basically lots of death, lots of destruction. End of the movie. More like it kind of goes to chaos into third of the movie.
Right.
And so things kind of get convoluted after a little bit. This movie is all over the place. There's one point where one guy injects the serum into him while he's alive, and it causes him to have like a convulsion. Then it kind of calls back to the first movie in a way, and the idea that an overdose causes your body to explode.
Right.
Which actually, that is how they killed Dr. Hill in the first one. I forgot that that's how they killed Dr. Hill.
They
killed
the body
part. They kill him with the overdose.
Main body.
So basically he overdoses and then the guy's body explodes. And then like, of course there's a funny scene where his skeleton's like, oh, I want another hit, man. All semblance of seriousness is gone.
This one's definitely a full tilt, silly movie. You know, it's just, he's definitely leaning more into the comedy, not even necessarily the comedy, but literally the silliness of everything. I mean, we got the rat warden, we got the junkie who's just like injecting himself with it, and you know,
and,
even
and
though he's
we,
like melting, that you know, he's
for those
he's,
who have
he's
not seen the film, when we say rat warden, like we're talking full on, like arms up
big
to the
ears,
chest, big ears,
his nose
like,
has come
his,
out,
his,
yeah,
his nose is coming out, teeth. And his teeth are like elongating in front, like he's full on like transformation to his entire body, not just acting like a rat.
Well, I did want to mention too, though, that you keep calling him son of Reanimator, but his name in the movie is Dr. Howard Phillips. So, I mean, he's
sure, but we don't need to worry about his actual name.
Well, of course, because it's Howard Phillips Lovecraft. So, you know, it's an homage to that. You know, it's a way to pull him into that. But this movie's just really silly. Again, this one's definitely the lesser of the three. And I still like it because it is goofy and weird, and it continues the overall story. But it's definitely not as good as even the second one is. And it's just because it's all over the place. It's kind of a very thin story. Generally speaking, the performance are just kind of, it's just too silly. You know, it's for me anyway, it was fun, but it was just a little too goofy for me.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it just kind of drags. It actually makes the movie drag a bit. Makes it feel longer than it is.
I watched that one last, and it's actually surprisingly the most forgettable movie of the three. Like, I really can't. I honestly can't remember a whole lot beyond a couple of like the more important details about it. I can't remember how the reporter's character resolves. I know the rat warden gets electrocuted in an electric chair, and then I can't remember how she gets resolved. And then I believe Howard gets pulled out by the police, but Herbert gets away because he steals the identification of Howard medical doctor.
But this is the only one where West escapes and he's alive at the end. Like each of the previous two installments, he dies. Yeah. So, you know, it's
bizarre. A bold move after what a wild, ridiculous movie to leave it open for a sequel.
Yeah. Yeah.
And just be like, yeah, people are going to want more of this.
I don't even know if it was necessarily that, but they were just like, okay, well, this one we're gonna let him live. We killed him off in the last two, you know, we might as well let him live in this one.
Yeah. And so I mean, it was like, I don't even know if I can say it was fun. it was definitely something.
Not boring.
No,
and that's what I'll say. It's not boring. It's I wouldn't say it's necessarily fun. It's goofy and weird. And you can have some enjoyment in it, especially Just going into it, knowing that, mm-hmm. and knowing that it's not going to be as good as the first one is at all, and just enjoy it for what it is. It's just more Herbert West. And as long as you can go into it knowing that, then you're good.
If you're bought in already and you already watched the first two and you're like, man, I want to know what happens next. Then you can watch this one. I would be very surprised if this one leaves you wanting more. I feel like any desire that I had wanting more after the second one was ceremoniously murdered with this movie. Just because, and it's not even necessarily because of just like how bad it is. It's just that it didn't, like, it just seems like such a departure. Like there's a certain element of it that just feels so against the feel and the themes of the first two movies inside of this one that it just kind of feels like they were kind of trying to jump the shark in a way. Like they were just trying to progress the narrative in an interesting way by having be like, well, what if you had like a little light bulb? You put a light bulb in the body and like created a soul, which again, not a terrible idea. Like it's very mad scientist. It definitely fits within the Lovecraftian kind of mythos of like weird, like pseudo magic technology. Right. And so I was actually fine with that. That just everything surrounding that idea is the stuff that kind of makes the movie fall apart. Like even the idea of Herbert inside of a prison isn't a terrible idea. Like that is a kind of unique aspect of like, yeah, I'm sure there would be bodies in a prison that like come in and every now and again that provide him subjects.
Yeah, exactly.
And so I think that it's definitely a unique sense of it. I just think that the framed narrative of the evil warden and the reporter and everything else just kind of made everything kind of fall apart. Where I said that the second one was worth a watch, Beyond Reanimator really is only if you want to like,
yeah, only if you want to. Yeah, exactly. I would say only watch it if you're really like interested in completing the saga, you know?
Yeah.
And even then you can really not watch it and be okay.
Yeah. There wasn't anything that I feel about Beyond Reanimator is like, oh, you gotta at least see this. Like there isn't even anything like clip worthy inside of the movie. Like there isn't something where I'd be like, hey, look up this clip. Like there really isn't anything. I mean, like you at least got Garbage Day out of Silent Night. But like, you know, there really isn't a Garbage Day moment inside of this movie. It's just bad. It's just a bad movie. I really don't even think it's bad due to the acting. Cause I mean, Jeffrey Combs still brings his like unique acting to Herbert in this. It still feels like Herbert from him. It's just that a lot of the writing around him is just not great. So, I mean, if you like the character of Herbert West, then I would say that watch this. Like, watch it if you want to just see more of Jeffrey Combs being Herbert West, because he does a fantastic job. Jeffrey Combs delivers on his interpretation of Herbert West again. As for the other characters and just the rest of the narrative, it just wasn't for me. It didn't, for me, the Batwing Dr. Hill felt more in line with the movie than anything in this one.
Absolutely.
It just kind of was like, oh, he's in a prison. What can we do? Well, let's have like a mean prisoner guy who wants to hurt him for killing his pet rat. It's like, okay. Also, let's have like a weirdly religious, like really religious, like albino character that is supposed to be horrifying, as like the first reanimated corpse.
Right.
And so just like stuff like that just feels like really weird where they, it felt like they were kind of in a room just figuring out like, okay, like what could we do in a prison? And so, but in any case, I think that overall the trilogy of movies is strongest when you watch it as a duology. I think that the first and the second one watched together can be a fun movie night. If you're looking to engage just purely from the, like, you just want to know what it's about, just watch the first one. I think that's all you need. It leaves you with a good cliffhanger. And if that's all you want, just watch that one.
Yep. I agree. I think that, you know, you can, if the series is fine. It's has enjoyable moments throughout. The best one is the first one, obviously. The second one has some good moments to it and definitely worth the watch at least once. And I would say the third one is at least worth one watch. And because it's not a terrible movie. It doesn't really sit in line with the others so much, but it's got a few little things here and there that are kind of fun. But yeah, I mean, if you're only looking to watch one, just watch the original Reanimator. It's a classic. It holds together well, and it's a pretty complete story in it in and of itself. And you don't necessarily need to watch anything else past that.
I think that the third one can be really summarized by the fact that there's a fight between a penis and a rat. I think that's really all you need to know about the third one is that does occur. And in a surprise upset, the penis wins.
Well, if that doesn't tell you, if that isn't enough to get you to watch that movie, then I don't know what it is. So, and I think that's a good place to leave it.
Yeah.
So, all right. Well, why don't you tell people where they can find you online?
Yeah, you can find me at Saber Vista on Twitter or X now, I guess. And you can find me at Saber, I believe it's hyphen Vista on YouTube. And you can also find me at Saber Vista on Instagram. Trying to get some more content up there. So it might look a little barren when you guys look at it, but hopefully if this is in a like few months from when this releases, maybe there's some more stuff up there. But otherwise, I've really enjoyed talking about Herbert West, Reanimator. Yeah. I always love talking about H.P. Lovecraft. He's a quirky mind with a lot of quirky stories. I definitely am interested if we did some more Stuart Gordon films. I haven't seen any of his movies. Seems like he, at least from what I watched with Herbert West, it seems like he read the source material and honestly some of the closest book adaptations that I've ever seen.
Right.
And so I'd be interested to watch Dagon and Castle Freak and From Beyond.
Yeah.
And seeing how he interprets those stories as well.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. We'll have to give those a watch and do an episode on them. So sounds good.
I think that's another good trilogy.
Right. Stuart Gordon's Lovecraft movie.
Mythos.
Yeah. All right. Sounds good. I appreciate you coming on, and we'll definitely have you on again hopefully soon. We'll see how the schedule shakes out.
Yeah, I'm sure you got to give a break on the Cosmic Horror episodes.
Yeah. All right.
All right. Thank you.
Thanks again to Harrison for joining me. On Friday, Ollie Deitch joins me to talk about Captain America Civil War, and on Monday, we start a new series on the Saw franchise. Ariel Power Shop joins me to talk about Saw 1 and 2. Thanks for listening. Creepy and Geeky is a part of the Morbidly Beautiful Podcast Network. Please check out morbidlybeautiful.com/podcasts for more great shows. If you like what you've heard, please consider giving the show 5 stars and a review on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Also, please share the podcast on social media to help spread the word. Make sure to subscribe on your favorite podcast app or at creepyandgeeky.com. Music for the podcast is Gratitude, composed by Jerry Smith. You can follow the podcast on social media at Creepy and Geeky on both Twitter and Instagram. If you'd like to follow me, I'm GeekThulu on Twitter and Blue Sky, and Geek.Thulu on Instagram. You can support the podcast by ordering teas and more on TeePublic or by donating to the coffee page. All of the links are in the show notes. Finally, don't forget, stay creepy.